So I want you to take a second and just think about your own personality.
Yeah, like the actual core of who you are.
Right. Because for over 50 years, mainstream psychology basically told us that by the time you blow out the candles on your 30th birthday, your personality is locked in stone.
The wet cement has completely dried.
Exactly. I mean, sure, you might change your job or maybe your partner or, pick up some new hobbies, but the fundamental architecture of who you are.
How you react to stress, how open you are to new ideas.
Yeah, all of that. How you socialize, it was all considered this permanently fixed baseline. But what if that entire paradigm is just wrong?
It's a huge question because what if the foundation of the adult self isn't actually concrete?
Right. What if it's something more like iron? Like it's solid under normal conditions, but it's entirely capable of being heated up, melted down, and just completely reforged in a single afternoon.
Which is a concept that completely upends the absolute bedrock of clinical psychology. I mean, if you can take a fully formed adult and permanently alter a core personality trait in a matter of hours,
Yeah.
you aren't just treating a symptom anymore. You are structurally changing the human operating system.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive today. We are looking into this massive, just massive disruption in our understanding of the brain and the self.
It really is a paradigm shift.
It is. We are exploring the science of how a discrete, heavily controlled event can measurably and lastingly shift a core personality trait that was, supposed to be completely immovable.
And we have some truly phenomenal data to guide us through this today.
We really do.
We're anchoring this whole discussion in an incredibly detailed article from the August 2026 edition of the OOTW Journal.
Right, the one titled Psychedelics and Personality, The Openness Effect.
That's the one. But we're also pulling in the surrounding ecosystem of research that actually made that article possible.
Because it didn't just happen in a vacuum.
Exactly. We're looking at the foundational trials out of Johns Hopkins, the clinical work from Imperial College London, and of course, the sweeping longitudinal reviews of personality science.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really feel the impact of what this new data is doing, we kind of have to understand the sheer weight of the dogma it's up
Oh,
against.
absolutely. The dogma was heavy.
Right. We need to look at why science believed for literal decades that the adult personality was an unmoving target.
Well, the consensus didn't just come out of nowhere. I mean, it was built on mountains of longitudinal data.
Like the Roberts and Del Vecchio stuff, right?
Exactly. If we look at the Roberts and Del Vecchio quantitative review from the year 2000, which, is heavily cited in this space, they tracked massive cohorts of people across decades of their lives.
Is following them year after year.
Right, they were measuring psychometric stability. And the data was just overwhelming. Basically, after roughly age 30, your core traits
They
settle.
just lock in.
They lock in. You might see some incredibly slow microscopic drift as you enter your senior years, maybe, but sudden structural jumps. They simply do not happen in healthy adults.
I always think about it kind of like the foundation of a house.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, so when you are a teenager or, your early 20s, that house is still being framed. The rooms are shifting around.
Still figuring out where the kitchen go.
Exactly. But by the time you hit 30, the concrete foundation is poured and cured. The load-bearing walls are up.
And you don't mess with load-bearing walls.
No, you don't. Now you can redecorate the living room. You can buy some flashy new furniture, which, is the equivalent of taking a trip or learning a new language or going through a bad breakup.
Right, those are experiences.
Yeah, those are experiences happening inside the house, but you don't move the load-bearing walls after age 30.
That analogy maps perfectly onto the Big Five framework, actually, which is the standard model psychologists use to measure those load-bearing walls.
The OCEAN acronym.
Right. Anyone following behavioral science knows OCEAN. It stands for conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, and openness.
And those five traits, those are the structural beams.
Exactly. Those are the beams.
I mean, for you listening, this is exactly why your friends can predict your behavior so well. And it's why therapists rely on those beams being stationary.
They have to.
If someone comes into a clinic and they score exceptionally high on neuroticism, meaning, they have a highly reactive stress response and a tendency toward negative emotion, and they score very low on extroversion.
The therapist doesn't try to magically turn them into a carefree, extroverted socialite.
Right, because that would be fighting biology.
It would be fighting decades of entrenched neural pathways. Clinical therapy is largely about giving patients the tools to work around those load-bearing walls.
You help them build coping mechanisms that fit the house they already live in.
Precisely. If you have a highly neurotic baseline, cognitive behavioral therapy helps you manage the spikes. It doesn't try to rip out the entire foundation.
Which brings us to the real star of today's Deep Dive,
Okay.
which is openness, the O in the Ocean acronym.
The O.
Because when we talk about openness in a clinical psychometric sense, we aren't just talking about someone who is like willing to try a new sushi restaurant.
No, it's way deeper than that.
We are talking about a fundamental cognitive framework.
We are talking about intellectual curiosity, aesthetic sensitivity, imagination, and really importantly, a tolerance for ambiguity.
So someone high in openness naturally seeks out novel experiences, right?
Yeah, novel experiences and divergent ideas, they are comfortable when things aren't strictly black and white.
Whereas a person low in openness?
They prefer routine, tradition, the proven, and the familiar.
And according to that Robertson Del Vecchio data, once you settle into your specific level of openness as an adult, you stay there.
You stay there, period.
Well, until Catherine McLean and her team at Johns Hopkins University decided to test a very specific, very powerful sledgehammer against that wall.
Ah, yes, the 2011 McLean study.
It's incredible.
This is the paper that introduced the first real crack in the dogma.
The setup here is wild when you consider the whole fixed after 30 rule. McLean's team took healthy adults.
Right, healthy adults.
These weren't patients looking for a cure for severe depression or trauma. They were just normal, psychologically healthy volunteers.
And they brought them into a highly controlled, aesthetically curated clinical setting.
And administered a high dose of psilocybin.
Right. And then they ran them through the standard validated Big Five personality inventories. They did this before the session, and then again, long after the compound had completely left their systems.
And the results.
The results completely defied the established literature. Across those five load-bearing walls, one of them objectively moved.
Openness spiked.
Openness spiked significantly.
Wait, but seeing a spike right after a massive intervention isn't totally unheard of, right?
What do you mean?
Like, if I go on a month-long retreat in the Himalayas, I'm probably going to come back scoring higher on openness for a few weeks because I'm just buzzing from the novelty of it all.
Sure, the afterglow effect.
Yeah, but then the grind of daily life sets in, the neurochemistry normalizes, and my foundation just settles back to where it always was. So how do we know this isn't just a lingering afterglow from a deeply unusual weekend?
Well, that is the exact question the Hopkins researchers anticipated, which is why the most crucial data point in the McLean study isn't the initial spike at
It's
all.
the durability.
It's the durability. They brought these exact same healthy volunteers back for psychometric testing more than 14 months later,
Over a year.
over a year. And in a psychological study, 14 months is basically an eternity.
Seriously.
And what they found was that the trait of openness was still elevated significantly above their original pre-session baseline.
Wow.
The dial had been turned and it stayed turned. We are talking about a discrete, time-bound event, like literally a few hours on a Tuesday afternoon, creating a permanent structural widening of an adult's threshold for novelty and aesthetic experience.
I really want to dig into how a discrete event does that. Because, again, a vacation to the Himalayas is a novel experience, but it rarely rewrites your core traits permanently.
What's fascinating here is that it comes down to the scale of the novelty.
His scale.
Yeah, an exotic vacation is novel, sure, but it's novel within the normal bounds of human perception.
Right. You are seeing new buildings, eating new food, but you're still you.
Exactly. A high-dose psilocybin session under the right clinical conditions forces the brain into a state of novelty that everyday life physically cannot produce.
It's a completely different category.
It often involves a complete dissolution of the ordinary sense of self, what we call ego death, and emerging with entirely new cognitive landscapes.
The subjective experience is just off the charts.
Right. That level of profound, ineffable novelty leaves an imprint that doesn't just fade away like a good memory. It actually registers on these objective personality inventories because the person's actual operating system for processing reality has been updated.
But, the data in the OOTW journal highlights a really important caveat here. And we have to talk about this. The shift didn't happen to everyone who swallowed the capsule.
Not at all. And this is where the science gets incredibly nuanced.
Right, because if this was just a simple chemical reaction, everyone who took the same dose per kilogram of body weight would see the exact same shift in openness.
Like taking aspirin.
Exactly. But they didn't. Some people's personalities shifted dramatically, and others just stayed exactly the same.
This brings us to what the literature calls the mystical type experience gate.
The gate.
The McLean study found that the lasting increase in openness only occurred in participants who reported having a complete mystical type experience during their session.
Okay, we have to define that term, because mystical sounds like we are drifting away from rigorous clinical science into something, I don't know, a bit too esoteric.
I know, it sounds esoteric. But in the context of this research, it is a highly quantified psychometric metric.
They actually measure it.
Yes. The researchers use parameters established by Roland Griffiths in his landmark 2006 work. To qualify as a complete mystical type experience, the participant's subjective report has to hit very specific, measurable thresholds.
Like what?
It includes a profound sense of unity with all things, a deep feeling of sacredness, a transcendence of time and space, and crucially, a noetic quality.
Noetic meaning like the deep, unshakable feeling that the experience is revealing objective truth rather than just being a hallucination.
Yes, exactly. It feels more real than everyday reality. If a participant hit those specific markers, their openness increased and it stayed elevated.
But for the participants who took the exact same high dose of psilocybin but did not cross that specific mystical threshold,
their openness showed zero structural change.
Zero. They took the drug, they felt the physical effects, but the load-bearing wall didn't move an inch.
Nothing. And this emphasizes a recurring, absolutely vital theme in modern psychedelic science. The molecule isn't doing the reshaping.
It's the experience.
The experience that the molecule facilitates is what drives the change.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if the experience is the driver, it completely flips our standard pharmacological model on its head.
Totally.
Let me try an analogy here. Think of the psilocybin as a key to an incredible, massive art museum.
Okay, I'm listening.
So swallowing the pill just turns the lock and pushes you through the front doors. You are technically inside the building.
Right, the drug is in your system.
Yeah, but if you walk into that museum and you squeeze your eyes shut, put your hands over your ears, and actively refuse to engage with any of the art,
you're just standing in the lobby.
Exactly. And eventually the museum closes, you leave the building, and you haven't been changed at all. The key didn't change you.
Right.
But if you walk in, open your eyes, and let the art absolutely terrify you or awe you or just completely break your heart, that engagement is what rewires you. The art does the work, not the key.
That captures the mechanism beautifully. The molecule is just the biochemical key. The subjective journey is the art.
It makes so much sense when you frame it that way.
We are just so conditioned by the passive model of Western medicine. If you have a headache, you take ibuprofen.
Right.
The molecule does the work in the background while you check your email. You don't need to have a deeply profound, insightful relationship with the ibuprofen for your headache to go away.
Exactly. I'm definitely not looking for a noetic breakthrough from my Advil.
Right. But this psychedelic intervention is an active, deeply experiential process. You cannot be a passive recipient. You have to walk through the gate and actually engage with whatever is on the other side.
And for you listening, this really frames mental health and personal growth as an active, experiential process rather than a passive, biochemical one.
It empowers the patient in a way.
It does. And we've seen how this museum works in healthy volunteers who are just looking for meaning or participating in a study. But what happens when we take this mystical gate and apply it to people whose rigid traits are actively destroying their quality of life?
That transitions the conversation from healthy baseline exploration into the acute clinical space.
The real heavy lifting.
Specifically, we have to look at the work of David Erritzo and his colleagues in 2018 at Imperial College London.
The stakes in the Erritzo study are so much higher. I mean, they were working with a cohort of 20 people suffering from treatment-resistant depression.
And when we say treatment-resistant, we mean these are individuals for whom the standard pharmaceutical toolkit has completely failed.
Nothing worked.
They have tried multiple SSRIs, SNRIs, standard talk therapy, and nothing has moved the needle. Their depression is deeply entrenched in their neural pathways.
To use our earlier analogy, their load-bearing walls are actively causing the house to collapse.
Exactly. So Erritzo's team gives this deeply suffering cohort psilocybin with extensive psychological support wrapped around the dosing session.
And the personality shift they recorded was much broader than what McLean saw, right? It wasn't just openness.
It was a multi-axis shift across the big five. The researchers saw a significant drop in neuroticism,
which is basically the holy grail for treating depression, right? Since neuroticism is the trait most heavily correlated with emotional volatility, anxiety, and deeply felt sadness.
Lowering neuroticism is always the primary target. But they didn't just see neuroticism fall. They saw extroversion rise.
Meaning these patients became more sociable.
Yes, more capable of drawing positive energy from the outside world. Conscientiousness trended upward slightly. Agreeableness stayed relatively flat.
But crucially, just like the healthy volunteers in the Hopkins study,
they saw a massive, significant rise in openness.
And here is the through line that really connects the healthy cohort to the depressed cohort. Erdso found that the magnitude of these personality shifts was directly predicted by the degree of insightfulness the patients reported experiencing during the session.
It comes right back to your museum analogy.
Yep.
The degree to which the patient felt they gained profound personal insight engaging with the art was the singular predictor of how much their structural personality moved.
It wasn't about milligram dosage per kilogram of body weight at all.
No, it was the psychological breakthrough that moved the needle.
Which perfectly explains why ecosystems like the OOTW Journal emphasize the surrounding support structure so aggressively.
They focus heavily on it.
When you read their material, they aren't treating this like a standard pharmaceutical rollout. They talk constantly about the container.
The container is paramount. This is why the sources detail tools like their spirit guide AI for preparation and integration.
Or their focus on rituals and wisdom ceremonies.
Exactly. If the subjective experience is what drives the structural change in the brain, then the environment holding that experience, the psychological prep beforehand, the physical safety during, and the therapeutic integration afterward is just as important as the molecule itself.
You aren't just dosing a patient in a sterile fluorescent-lit clinic and sending them home.
You are actively engineering a psychological space where a mystical type experience is actually safe to have.
The data from Erdso is just incredible. You take deeply depressed people, give them a supported experience, and their neuroticism plummets while their openness and extroversion bloom.
It's remarkable.
But, you know, if we are being responsible guides to this research for our listeners, we have to push back on this a bit.
We absolutely need to apply rigorous skepticism.
Because there is a very glaring counter-argument staring us right in the face.
Let's hear it.
Okay, if you have someone who has been profoundly clinically depressed for a decade, and they suddenly find relief, whether that relief comes from psilocybin, a new job, intensive therapy, or just falling in love, their personality is naturally going to look different on a survey.
Of course it is.
Right. If I'm miserable, I am going to score incredibly high on neuroticism and very low on extroversion. Mm-hmm. If I recover, I'm going to act less neurotic and more outgoing.
That's just the nature of feeling better.
So are we absolutely sure this is a fundamental alteration of their core personality? Or is it just the standard statistical footprint of someone who finally feels better?
It is the most vital question a psychometrician can ask. It's known in the field as the less depressed defense.
The less depressed defense.
Right. We have to figure out if we are measuring a genuinely new structural foundation or just measuring the absence of a crippling symptom.
And how do we do that?
Well, to resolve that, the literature points us to a 2023 study by Weiss and colleagues that tackled this exact overlap.
They did a direct comparison with standard antidepressants.
Yes. They looked at conventional SSRIs, specifically escitalopram, which is a very common daily medication for depression.
Okay.
And the data actually confirmed the skeptics' hypothesis. Standard antidepressants do nudge extroversion up and neuroticism down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When someone experiences mood relief from a daily pill, it naturally overlaps with those specific traits. So if Erdsozy's team had only measured extroversion and neuroticism, you would be entirely correct to dismiss the findings and say, well, this isn't a paradigm shift in personality science. This is just standard symptom relief.
But standard SSRIs don't touch the whole board.
Right. This raises an important question. What happens to openness?
The smoking gun.
Openness is the exception that proves the rule.
I love this part.
The Weiss study demonstrated that standard antidepressants, like escitalopram, do not reliably raise openness.
Not at all.
No. A daily SSRI might blunt your negative emotions, it might make you more functional and more willing to socialize, but it does not structurally increase your cognitive flexibility, your aesthetic imagination, or your tolerance for novel, ambiguous ideas.
So what does this all mean for the psilocybin data?
It means we can actually isolate the variable. because standard antidepressants don't raise openness, and because Catherine McLean's 2011 volunteers were completely healthy people with zero depression to recover from.
And they still showed a massive, durable rise in openness.
Exactly. Because of that, the psilocybin effect absolutely cannot be explained away as just mood relief in disguise.
That snaps the entire puzzle together. The healthy cohort had no mood disorder to resolve. Their rise in openness was a genuine, independent variable. It proves that the psychedelic experience is triggering a specific structural change to the bedrock of the personality, entirely separate from simply feeling less sad.
The dogma is officially broken. The adult personality can be permanently shifted.
But physically, mechanically, how does that actually happen?
The mechanics are fascinating.
I mean, it's one thing to see the survey scores change on a piece of paper, but what is physically occurring inside the skull to make a load-bearing wall move in an afternoon?
To understand the mechanics, we have to look at the leading two-part theory detailed in the OOTW journal, which really bridges advanced psychology with neurobiology.
Okay, let's get into it.
It starts with a massive disruption to the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN. That is essentially the brain's internal routing system for our sense of self, right?
That's a great way to describe it.
It's the network that maintains our autobiography, our ego, and our rigid thought patterns.
Yes. The DMN is highly active when we are daydreaming, ruminating, or just thinking about our past and future.
Like when you're just stuck in your own head.
Exactly. And in a depressed brain, the DMN is often hyperactive. It creates this rigid, inescapable loop of negative self-referential thought.
Just constantly beating yourself up.
Right. Now, psilocybin acts as an agonist at the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors, which leads to a profound temporary downregulation of the default mode network.
It just quiets it down.
It takes it offline. The rigid loops stop.
Which creates that psychological event we talked about earlier, the mystical experience, the ego dissolution.
Psychologically, this profound novelty acts as a shock to the system. Without the DMN enforcing all the old rigid rules of exactly who you are, the brain is forced to update deeply held beliefs about the self and the world.
It's a massive software update.
That is exactly what it is.
But, you know, a software update doesn't really matter if the physical hardware is too old or rigid to install it.
Which brings us to the second half of the mechanism, neuroplasticity.
Right.
Neuroplasticity is the brain's physical ability to rewire itself, to sprout new dendrites, and to form new synaptic connections.
Because as we age, our brains naturally become less plastic.
Right. The pathways become superhighways, and it's very hard to build new roads. But the biological data indicates that 5-HT2A agonists trigger a cascade of neurotrophic factors, like BDNF.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Yes. And this flood of BDNF opens a critical temporary window of hyperplasticity.
So while the DMN is offline and the profound psychological software update is happening, the physical hardware of the brain is temporarily unlocked, flooded with BDNF, and actually able to save the new code.
You've got it. The novel state of consciousness lands perfectly during a biological window when the brain is unusually capable of revising its physical structure.
That is amazing.
And there is a remarkable, almost poetic symmetry here between the psychology and the biology.
Wait, what do you mean?
Think about the definition of the specific trait that is changing. Openness.
Okay.
Psychologically, openness is receptivity to new experiences, cognitive flexibility, and divergent thinking.
Right.
Biologically, what is the state of the brain during that neuroplastic window? It is physically malleable, flexible, and receptive to new neural connections.
Oh, wow.
The psychological trait of openness is almost a literal description of the brain's physical, plastic, post-session state made durable.
It's like the brain's temporary physical state of being open to rewiring gets frozen into the personality itself.
Exactly.
I keep picturing this entire process like blacksmithing.
Blacksmithing, walk me through that.
Okay, so your adult personality by age 30 is a solid piece of iron. It's cold, it's hard, it holds its shape.
The fixed bedrock Roberts and Delvecchio measured.
Right. Taking the psychedelic compound is like putting that solid iron into a blazing forge. The 5-HT2A agonism and the BDNF flood heat up the iron of your personality until it literally glows red hot and becomes physically malleable.
That's the neuroplasticity window.
Exactly. Then the hammer strikes.
Yeah.
That's the novel mystical experience, the deep insight we talked about. And it physically bends the iron into a completely new shape.
But the crucial part of blacksmithing is what happens when you take the iron out of the fire.
Right. You pull it out and it has to cool down. As it cools, the neuroplastic window closes and the new shape sets, becomes solid iron again, but now it has a completely new form.
A higher level of openness.
Yeah. But that cooling process is critical.
Yeah.
You can't just leave a red-hot piece of iron on the anvil, walk away, and hope it randomly forms into a useful tool.
No, it needs intention. And in the clinical world, that controlled cooling process is what the ecosystem calls integration.
Integration.
The molecule opens the window of plasticity. The subjective insight shapes the iron. But integration, the intensive therapy, the journaling, the intentional lifestyle, changes in the days and weeks following the session. That is what builds and solidifies the new neural pathways before the window closes entirely.
It makes sense. Traits don't change by willpower alone, but they also don't change just because you swallowed a pill.
They change by perceiving the world entirely differently during a brief biological window when the brain can actually consolidate that shift, and then doing the hard, sober work to integrate that shift into your daily reality.
This all sounds incredibly promising. Honestly, it sounds a little like magic.
It does.
But as guides to the listener, we have to look at the fine print. We have to look at the honest limitations of the science, because it is far too easy for this kind of paradigm-shifting data to just get swallowed by hype.
And to its immense credit, the OOTW Journal provides a very sober, rigorous framing of these limitations.
They don't sugarcoat it.
No.
Yeah.
These compounds are not magic bullets, and it is scientifically and ethically irresponsible to treat them as such.
Let's run through the caveats, starting with the science itself.
Well, the foundational studies we are discussing, McLean at Hopkins, Arezzo at Imperial Head, they are incredibly compelling, but they suffer from small n sizes.
Right, the sample size.
We are talking about dozens of participants, not phase three trials with thousands of people. Furthermore, in psychedelic research, it is notoriously difficult to have ideal placebo controls.
The active placebo problem. Because if you give one group a high dose of psilocybin and the control group a sugar pill or even like a mild niacin flush, everyone knows within 45 minutes who got the real drug.
Exactly. You can't truly blind the participants or the researchers.
Which introduces a massive potential for expectancy bias and self-reporting flaws, doesn't it?
It really does. The big five inventories, while highly validated, still rely on people answering questions about themselves.
And if someone just had a life-changing weekend.
Right. If a participant just had what they believe is the most profoundly meaningful, sacred experience of their entire life, their sheer enthusiasm might artificially inflate their survey scores in the immediate aftermath. We have to account for that glow artificially bumping the psychometrics.
But what about the long-term durability? We talked about the McLean study following up at 14 months, which is, you know, great for a study, but...
But 14 months is a blip in an actual human lifespan.
Yeah.
The durability of this openness shift beyond a year or two is simply not fully mapped by the current science. We don't really know if that forged iron eventually bends back to its original shape over a decade of normal life stress.
Then there are the harsh medical realities. These are powerful, controlled substances.
Extremely powerful.
The clinical trials we are talking about involved intensive, rigorous psychological and physiological screening before anyone was even allowed near a dosing room.
This cannot be overstated. Psychedelics are categorically not safe for everyone.
Right.
The exact mechanisms that disrupt the default mode network and induce hyperplasticity can be highly destabilizing for some brains. The literature explicitly cites severe risks for individuals with a personal or family history of psychosis, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder.
It can trigger things.
In those individuals, these compounds can trigger severe, long-lasting manic or psychotic episodes.
Which really grounds the conversation. For you listening, this isn't a personality rewrite on demand. You don't just walk up to a pharmacy counter, hand over a prescription and say, yes, I'd like to be 20% more extroverted and gain 50 points of openness by next Tuesday, please.
It is definitely not a transaction. Not everyone who takes a psychedelic will cross the mystical type experience gate.
And if you don't cross it?
If you don't have that specific subjective breakthrough, as the data showed, you likely won't see the structural shift in openness at all. And even if you do cross that gate, the integration requires profound effort.
So, if we synthesize all of this, the Hopkins data, the Imperial College clinical trials, the biological mechanisms, and the very real limitations, what does the evidence actually support?
When you strip away the cultural hype and look only at the rigorously gathered data, the evidence supports this. under highly supportive, carefully controlled clinical conditions, a psychedelic experience, specifically one that achieves the measurable threshold of a complete mystical experience, can produce a significant, durable increase in the core personality trait of openness.
So it's real.
It represents a genuine, documented crack in the dogma of the fixed adult self.
We started this deep dive talking about the wet cement of personality trying by age 30, the load-bearing walls of who we are anchored in place for the rest of our lives.
And we saw how decades of longitudinal psychometrics supported that exact dogma.
But then we looked at Catherine McLean's healthy volunteers and David Erazzo's severely depressed patients.
Yes.
And we saw that when you introduce a profound mystical-type shock to the system, guided by the right container and psychological support, one of those massive load-bearing walls, openness can actually be moved.
It moves through an elegant biological and psychological pairing, a massive software update to our cognitive worldview, occurring perfectly inside a temporary biological hardware window of heightened neuroplasticity.
The iron glows red, bends under the weight of the insight, and sets into a new, more receptive shape.
But it requires the gate. It requires actually engaging with the art in the museum, not just holding the key.
And it requires the integration to make it last.
It is not a magic wand, but it is an unbelievably profound tool.
It really is.
Before we wrap up, I want to pose a final thought for you to ponder.
Oh, definitely.
We have spent this entire hour looking at this on a very individual clinical level, how one person's neuroplasticity works, how one depressed patient finds relief. But let's extrapolate strictly from the psychometric definitions we've discussed today.
Let's zoom out.
The trait of openness represents a tolerance for the new. It represents intellectual receptivity, aesthetic curiosity, cognitive flexibility, and a willingness to entertain novel, unprecedented ideas without panicking. We now possess a scientific mechanism that, under the right conditions, can measurably and durably raise this specific trait in adults who are otherwise totally set in their ways.
Okay.
So what happens if this treatment scales?
Wow.
Imagine not just one person, but a widespread societal increase in the trait of openness. If a critical mass of rigid, fully formed adults suddenly experienced a structural increase in their tolerance for new ideas, how might that alter the way an entire society approaches rigid, seemingly intractable global problems?
That's huge.
How might it change the way deeply polarized factions relate to opposing viewpoints? Or even simply, how might a society with a structurally elevated baseline of openness create, fund, and consume art?
If the load-bearing walls of a whole culture started to shift... That is a staggering question.
It is.
It goes far beyond clinical psychology. It touches on sociology, politics, art, everything. It suggests that our collective personality might not be as permanently fixed as we thought either. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning the dogma, and most importantly, stay open to the new.